This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. We are now at episode number 62, and I'm really excited about today's episode. We are meeting with New York Times bestselling author Lori Gottlieb, who just released the book, Maybe You Should Talk to Somebody, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And listen to this quote by Irvin Yalom on this book. I've been reading books about psychotherapy for over a half century, but have never encountered a book like this one, so bold and brassy, so packed with good stories, so honest, deep, and riveting. That was Irvin Yalom, the world-famous Irvin Yalom, quoting this book on Lori Gottlieb's new book, and just really excited to be bringing this book and this author to you, and I'm just going to get right into it. So, really quick, Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author who writes the weekly Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic, where she's also a contributing editor, a sought-after expert on relationships and mental health topics. She has appeared on Today, Good Morning America, Early Show, MSNBC, CNN, Dr. Phil, and NPR. And so, yeah, without further ado, let's chat with Lori Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Somebody, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Okay. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the Radical Therapist Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. And I should probably start by congratulating you for debuting on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's got to be exciting. I guess my first question, I should let everybody know, I love the book. It was wonderful. I don't finish a lot of books, right? And I don't know what kind of reader you are. I don't finish a lot of books, but I finished this one and it was great. And but I guess my first question for you is that what was it like being a therapist who wrote a very intimate book describing many revealing experiences? And you're in a field with a long tradition of like no self-disclosure or embracing the blank slate metaphor. And I'm wondering, did you hold any concerns about kind of putting yourself out there in such a way that you did while writing this book?
Yes, definitely. I think it's really hard to toe that line between being a human with your own life and being a therapist, where it's very different because you're not bringing yourself in that way to the therapy room. You're bringing your personality and your experiences and your humanity to the therapy room, but you're not disclosing information about your personal life. Mm-hmm. But I did it for a reason, and I really wanted to not just bring people into the therapy room with me as a clinician so that they could see how people get through their struggles and kind of the real version of life and also the heroic moments and the triumphant moments. But I wanted them to see me as a person too, because I think that we're more the same than we are different. That's a big theme in the book.
Right.
And I wanted them to see me as sort of the fifth patient at times, and then also the clinician at other times.
Yeah, this book is constructed, I'm going to try to avoid any spoilers and all of that while we're going through this, but this book is constructed around the end of a relationship that was very confusing and painful for you, and you eventually find your way into therapy, but it took you a little bit, and I'm wondering, why do you think it took you a while to seek therapy, and when you did decide to go, what were the challenges of being a therapist looking for a therapist?
That's such a great question, because even though as a therapist, I know that there isn't any stigma to going to therapy, I think that sometimes we feel like we can handle it ourselves. You know, I think we feel like, well, stiff upper lip, I understand this, I understand what happened, and I just have to kind of move through it. And that's the worst thing you can do. But I think that it took a friend of mine to say, you know, maybe you should talk to someone. I was, even though I was very functional at work and very functional, you know, with my family, with my son, I think that, you know, I was like, I left my credit card at Target. I tripped over a step in my garage. I couldn't focus, you know, with other things. And I think that, you know, it was hard for me to kind of acknowledge, yeah, I need help. And then what was it like being a therapist in therapy? You have to really just be, take off your therapist hat. You can't backseat drive. You can't say, I don't know, I would have said something different there.
Right.
You just have to let go. And I think for a lot of people, therapist or not, sometimes it's hard to be in a room with someone and just let go.
Yeah. You also write about, and you kind of take this on the book, you write about, though, even though we're a more open society, there is still, open in a lot of different ways, there's still a stigma around emotional struggles. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
I think that we value our physical health differently from our emotional health. So if somebody is experiencing chest pain, they will go to a cardiologist to get that checked out.
Right.
More often than not, before they have a massive coronary. But I think what happens is if you're experiencing emotional pain or something feels off emotionally, we kind of minimize our pain and we say, well, I have a roof over my head and I have food on the table. So therefore, why should I be sad or anxious or struggling or grieving or whatever it is? And so we don't, you know, we kind of push the feelings down, and that actually makes them bigger because they need air. And eventually, you know, they'll come out in behaviors. They'll come out in, a colleague of mine calls the internet the most soothing non-prescription painkiller out there. because you know, I think people will like go on their phones, they'll go on the internet, whatever they can do to avoid their feelings, but they'll come out. And people often don't land in therapy until they're having the equivalent of an emotional heart attack. And at that point, it's harder to treat because you're farther along with it. But also, you've suffered unnecessarily for a certain amount of time, whereas you could have come in and gotten help earlier.
Hmm. Yeah, and in the book, you do a wonderful job of sharing like all the emotions and insecurities of someone entering into therapy as a client, and I'm including like how do you decide where you sit in the room and wondering if your therapist likes you, et cetera. And I'm wondering, can you say a little bit about that, but also how do you imagine this experience has influenced you now and in the work you do now?
I think that as a patient, I was very much like my patients are with me. And that's a really good experience to have as a therapist.
Right.
Because most of us who are therapists have been in therapy as part of at the very least, as part of our training, because we have to do a certain number of hours of our own therapy. But it's different, I think, once you've been practicing for a while and you go back to therapy. You know, there's an awkwardness to starting that relationship. It's a unique relationship, I think, in the sense that it's one of the few in the world where you know going in that you're going to form this very intimate relationship with somebody and have to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. And so how does that happen? With my therapist, I did want him to like me. I think most of us wonder whether a therapist like us. You know, when I would leave and I would see another patient in the waiting room, I think, my session was such a downer today. He's probably looking forward to hers.
Yeah.
Or, you know, does he look forward to her sessions more than mine? The typical things I think that people wonder about. But I think it was really helpful for me. As therapists, we don't see other therapists do their work generally. And so I was really learning from my therapist too, because he had much more experience than I did at the time that I went to see him. And he just brought his whole personality into the room. He was very boundaried. He didn't disclose things about his personal life, but he was just very much himself in the room in a way that I think a lot of clinicians, when we're being trained, we think that we have to be kind of more, that there's an expectation of a kind of professionalism that seems a little bit robotic almost. And that's not what our professors are trying to instill in us, but I think that's sometimes what we take away. So I think he taught me how to be utterly myself in the room. And I think that really helps my patients more.
Yeah. I'm going to read something from the book actually in the beginning. And this is after the night after your boyfriend broke up with you. You wrote that our training has taught us theories and tools and techniques, but worrying beneath our hard earned expertise is the fact that we know just how hard it is to be a person which is to say we still come to work each day as ourselves with our own set of vulnerabilities, our own longings and insecurities, and our own histories. Of all my credentials as a therapist, my most significant is that I'm a card-carrying member of the human race. And you go on, I've heard you say in a previous interview that our humanity is our greatest tool in therapy. And I'm wondering if you could just say a little bit, I know you've touched on that, but if you could say a little bit more about that.
It's interesting because our humanity is our greatest tool in the sense of nobody wants to go see a robot, right? Nobody wants to go see the brick wall. I think that the fact that we understand struggle, and it doesn't have to look like our patient struggles. It could be more, it could be less. It doesn't matter. It's just that we know what it's like to be human. I think that nobody is immune to struggle. And that's no matter who they are, no matter how charmed their lives might seem. It's just part of the human condition that we all struggle in certain ways. And I think that that's really important in order to understand other people's struggles. And one of the examples I give in the book is a colleague of mine. She and her husband were really struggling to have a child, and they'd gone through so many disappointments. And she finally got pregnant, and she was standing in a Starbucks when her doctor called to tell her that the pregnancy wasn't viable. And she burst into tears in the Starbucks. And a patient happened to walk in, saw the sobbing therapist, made eye contact with her and left, and then never came back to therapy. And so I think it's interesting because if I had seen that, yes, it would have been a little bit awkward. I certainly wouldn't want to see my therapist do that, you know, take that call in the therapy room. But I think that it would make me feel safer and trust her all the more because she had a really normal human reaction to something very painful. Mm-hmm. And I think that that makes people connect. It's sort of the glue, is that we know what it's like to just, you know, deal with the daily problems of living.
Yeah, that's great. And this kind of leads me into my next question. In the book, you write about our clients being mirrors, and it's something I often say to the people that I supervise as well, and it was nice to see that in your book, and I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
I think that I talk in the book about how we grow in connection with others and how a therapist will hold up a mirror to a patient in a way that the person can't see themselves. So we want them to see their reflection, and we want them to see the things that they're not aware of, their blind spots, the ways that they keep shooting themselves in the foot over and over and ending up in the same place. Mm-hmm. But also, as we help them see themselves more clearly, we start to see ourselves more clearly too. So some of the same questions, I think, especially the universal existential questions that people come in with about how to be loved, how to love other people, how to deal with regret, how to manage our past, how to manage our circumstances, what is meaning, what is purpose, you know, how to be vulnerable, all of those things, I think we deal with too. And because we're helping them to really focus on them, I think that the mirror reflects back at us too as we're grappling with whatever we are in our own lives. It forces us, I think, to ask ourselves the same questions in a deeper way.
Thank you for that. Also, in the book, you used the metaphor of, I'm going to kind of tap onto this, of the music under the lyrics. And you talk a bit about kind of the narratives that we organize our lives around, and that you're kind of always looking for the music under the lyrics. And it's such a kind of beautiful phrase. I was wondering if you could say something about that.
When people come into the therapy room, they usually talk about what we like to call the content. My boyfriend broke up with me. This is happening with my partner. Here's what's happening with my child. This is what my mother did. And I'm listening to the underlying struggle. So not just what they're saying, the lyrics, but what is the struggle or pattern that got them into that situation in the first place? So I want to hear what the pattern is, and not just the, and then he said, and then she said, and then here's what happened. Mm-hmm. And I think we all have a tendency to kind of stay in the content, but if you really want to move forward and understand something so that you can change something for the long term, you're going to have to listen for the music under the lyrics. And that's why when people come in too, I'm listening not just to their story, but how flexible they are with their story. Mm-hmm. Can they imagine what the other people in the story would say if they were telling the exact same story? Could they imagine another perspective on it?
Mm-hmm. That's great. You also talk about, this is interesting, you also talk about idiot compassion and wise compassion. I wonder if you could say a little bit about that.
This is something that I think has been really helpful to me personally, especially when I went to therapy. Idiot compassion is what we do with our friends. It's, we take their side. We don't want to rock the boat. We say, yes, your boss is a jerk, mm-hmm. even though this, you've been in this situation 10 other times, you know, in other jobs. You know, we want people to feel supported. And I think that, that may be helpful in the short term, in the moment. It feels good to be validated in that way, but it doesn't help people to see what their role might be in the situation. And even if they didn't necessarily have a role in the situation, how do they choose to respond to the situation? Can they respond in a different way? So that it's not so painful. But I think in the therapy room, we use wise compassion, which is really saying, hey, I want you to look at the situation a little bit differently. A lot of people come to therapy, and myself included, because they want validation. They want the therapist to agree with them. Yeah, you dodged a bullet there. Yeah, this person was unreasonable. But I think that that's not so helpful for the long term.
Right. Agreed. And I guess I would like to maybe turn to writing now. I know you were, as I understand it, you were writing kind of long before you became a therapist. And we have a lot of therapists and social workers and counselors that listen to this podcast. And I'm sure several of them have aspirations of writing or writing a book. And I'm wondering if you could share some of your best advice for those in the helping professions, your best writing advice. What would you recommend?
So I had an interesting situation where I was a writer before I became a therapist. Mm. So it's almost like asking a fish what it's like to be in the water, in the sense of that was where I always was.
Right.
So writing was very second nature, or first nature, I guess, to me, second nature. Mm. It was the thing that I did. But I think it's very similar, you know, and I think that for people who want to write, who are in the helping professions, I think we deal with story all day long.
Yeah.
So anybody who's doing this kind of work has so many stories, and there are the stories in their own lives, which I tell in the book, and there are the stories of the patients, which of course you need a lot. You need to get the permissions. You need to change everything. You know, I mean, I think they know sort of what they need to do in terms of legal and ethical concerns.
Right.
And, you know, but I think that I think people who come into this profession are really interested in story and the human condition. So it's not, I think it makes natural sense that they would want to write. So I would say my best advice is write. I mean, I know that sounds simple, but just start writing. And then see what it is that you want to do. I was a journalist, so it was different. I've never written novels or short stories. I've always written nonfiction. But a lot of people want to write fiction, too. And I would say just write.
Yeah. How hard was it for you to move from nonfiction to really doing what you did now, which is nonfiction, I guess, in some ways, but it was very...
It's nonfiction, right. So yeah. I've never written fiction.
Yeah, okay.
So it was very much what I do as a journalist. I think that the difference here was that I had an emotional stake in it,
right.
I was writing about people that I very much cared about, my patients. And I was also... writing very openly about myself, which, you know, my patients are anonymous. So even though I write about them, nobody knows who they are.
Right.
But for me, you know, since my name's on the book, everybody knows that, you know, when I'm writing about me in the book, that's a real person. That's the author of this book. And so I'm much more exposed in a lot of ways than my patients are because, you know, I'm obviously identifiable and they're not.
Now, how can our listeners find you? You have a regular column on The Atlantic?
I do. So I write the Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. It appears every Monday, and it's kind of like a therapeutic take on an advice column, meaning I don't give a lot of prescriptive advice. I help people to think about their problems the way that a therapist might be thinking about it if they came in for a first session, but maybe we wouldn't say it like that in the first session because we don't yet have that relationship with them. And so I really want them to think about their, sort of like what we were talking about earlier about story. I want them to reframe their story in a way that will help them feel less trapped by it, less stuck in it. So that's what I do in the column. And so they can find me at The Atlantic every Monday. They can also find me on my website, which is my name, LoriGottlieb.com. And I am on Twitter at LoriGottlieb1. And they can read the book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone.
Yeah, which is great. And I will link it in the show notes as well so they can access it. And I just want to say, Lori, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Well, that's our show, and I hope you enjoyed that. And the book can be, there's a link in the show notes for the book. So if you want to, if that inspired you enough to go get the book, and you should, it's a really great book. Go to the show notes and click on the link, and you can get the book by Lori. And if you want Radical Therapist stickers, let me know. Shoot me an email. I'd be happy to get those out to you. Come find the Radical Therapist on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at the Rad Therapist, and on our website. And I always like getting emails from you. So if you have some suggestions, want to say hi, or whatever, please email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Always like hearing from you. And as always, you know, maybe share this episode with somebody, or if you're listening to it on iTunes, go ahead and rate and review the show. That would be very much appreciated. I hear that's how we or people get to know about it. So please consider doing that. And yeah, I think that's it. As always, I'm Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.